This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Alice Siebold, is the author of the novel The Lovely Bones, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 6 months. Time magazine described it as the breakout fiction debut of the year. The story is about the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the subject matter made her reluctant to pick up the book, but reading it gave her a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. The author, Alice Siebold, is also the author of Lucky, a memoir in which she recounts being raped when she was a college freshman. The Lovely Bones begins with an attack on the young teen, who is raped, tortured, and killed. The rest of the novel is narrated from heaven, with the girl observing her family and friends as they try to carry on after her death. Terry spoke with Alice Siebold this summer.
I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering why write about something so horrible, so unthinkable, the rape and dismemberment of a 14-year-old girl.
Because it's part of life. You know, that's the simplest answer, I think, for me. It's very much part of the experience of what it is to live in this culture. It happens all the time.
Now, you were raped yourself when you were a freshman in college, and that's a subject of an earlier book you wrote, a memoir. And reading those two books back to back, I was really struck by the difference in the descriptions of the rape. The rape, as you describe it in your memoir, is very brutal, very detailed in its brutality. It's as if you're reliving every moment and describing it like a journalist.
Mm-hmm. I think they are very different books in my mind, even though they both not only have violence but start out in violence. One of them is factual, and I tell every detail in some way in the memoir. And the other one is a fictive voice, and there's so much more being given in the first chapter of The Lovely Bones in terms of getting to know her character and some of the facts of her family and her background.
I got the impression that the kind of moment-by-moment description of the brutality that's in your memoir is something you felt didn't belong in this new novel, in the description of the brutality that this 14-year-old faces.
Yeah, the funny thing is that I did write the beginning of The Lovely Bones before I wrote my memoir. So Susie's, the violent crime that occurs in Susie's life happened in terms of writing about it before a description of my own rape was written by me later. I think in order to separate the two stories to make sure that Susie was not doing any of my work for me when I returned to the novel, I stopped to write Lucky. And one of the things that it was very important for me to do was to get all the facts down of my own case. So they had been written, they existed whole in a whole nother book, and I could go back to Susie and she could lead me where she wanted to take me and tell me her story in the way she wanted to tell it, as opposed to me feeling perhaps that I needed to really tell the real deal about every detail about rape and violence. I did that in the memoir as opposed to the novel. Because I wanted my characters to rule the novel, not some sort of desire to talk about rape and reveal rape to readers.
Your memoir ends, "I live in a world where the two truths coexist, where both hell and hope live in the palm of my hand." Is that in a way where your novel picks up with hell and hope or hell and heaven being side by side?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my major motivations in terms of how I live my life. And also, though, why I see fiction as so incredibly important is to be able to give, in a very short space, the context for those two things coexisting and coexisting in an honest way, where hope is really springing out of something that was is hard won, as opposed to purchased in the, you know, how to cope section at the local bookstore.
After Susie is raped and killed and mutilated, and this is in the first chapter, she goes to heaven, and the rest of the story is narrated by her as she experiences this part of heaven and looks down on her family and neighbors as they go on without her. What interested you in this idea of your narrator being in heaven looking down on the people she's had to leave behind?
I think I needed to find a way, and first I have to say that, again, when Susie's voice presented it to me, she presented completely, and she was already in heaven. So that was something, when I got to the end of the first 15 pages, which I did not know was going to be the first chapter of a novel, I had my character, I had where she was, and I had what had happened to her. And because she was such a bossy main character, I had no choice. I had to follow her. So though it was not conscious a choice to place her in heaven, once I realized that she had put me there in some way, it is a position from which she can tell a story to a reader and bring a reader to places that they wouldn't have access on. And that she wouldn't have access on unless she were in heaven. And to see, referring back to the previous question about heaven and hope or hope and hell, all those things, to see those things put together in a context that is ultimately in some way horrible but doesn't have to be so threatening that readers are afraid to read about the truth or about the reality that a girl like Susie would experience.
Can you describe the heaven that you've created for Susie?
It's a heaven with what I'd say is a lot of open spaces. It was much more detailed in early drafts of the book, and it was an experience in creating where I wrote much more than ultimately remained, knowing what to take away so that people can bring their own ideas of things into the heaven that remains. There's something probably strangely like the open fields of suburbia about the heaven that Susie inhabits, because in the book, the heaven would reflect a bit of what the person had experienced or known on Earth. There are also silly things like the textbooks that she has are 17 in vogue, because that, in her case, as a 14-year-old girl, would be a textbook that she'd want to have. And then there are other things that are not, say, fun or familiar. And those are the things to try to figure out how to rectify the situation that she's in and look at the people on Earth and see them really suffering, and how to cope and understand herself with that as they are coping and understanding with her loss on Earth.
You write about the burden of guilt on the parents in the novel. Susie says about her father, "Every day he got up, before sleep wore off, he was who he used to be. Then as his consciousness woke, it was as if poison seeped in. At first he couldn't even get up. He lay there under a heavy weight, the guilt on him, the hand of God pressing down on him, saying, 'You were not there when your daughter needed you.'" Do you want to talk a little bit about the guilt you imagine the parents feeling?
It's an interesting thing. Some of the father was another character for me in the novel that was there very quickly, very immediately, and he really, to me, is the heart of the family. I think, particularly with a sexual assault crime, whether the victim, if the victim is a child, whether it's a male or a female child, fathers often feel extremely responsible for what happens in that way to their children. They want to be able to fix it very, very much and go out and do something. And it has become somewhat stereotypical in movies and television that the father wants to go and catch or kill the perpetrator. But the truth is that it's a stereotype that reflects reality. In my own experience, I can count the number of times that, you know, both my father but also boyfriends, male friends, particularly would say things like, you know, "I want to kill the bastard." Just in this desire to do something, and also to great shame because the perpetrator is male. And for the mother in The Lovely Bones, it throws her into a whole reevaluation of what her life has been about. Obviously, there have been problems with her understanding of its value before this. But then in the loss of her daughter, it throws her again into this questioning about what she's done with her life and whether it was actually indeed what she wanted to do with it.
Our guest is Alice Siebold, author of the best-selling novel The Lovely Bones. She'll talk more with Terry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Alice Siebold, author of the novel The Lovely Bones. It's the story of a 14-year-old girl who is raped and murdered, then goes to heaven where she observes her family trying to carry on without her. Siebold is also the author of Lucky, a 1999 memoir about being raped. She spoke with Terry this summer.
After you were raped, when you were trying to figure out what you were doing with your life and dealing with all the wounds that this rape left you with, psychological and physical, were you at the same time watching your parents dealing with a different set of wounds caused by the same rape?
Definitely, particularly my mother, I think. You know, it just hits the entire family like a ton of bricks. And trauma is, especially when it's a trauma that is not a well-known trauma for those traumas that are well-known, really, there's so much to try to understand. I remember watching television, say, with my sister, after the rape, when I was just basically lying on the couch and trying to recover. And if anything came on that made her maybe think about violence or whatever, she would stare back at me, and it made me highly self-conscious. But she was deeply trying to understand what my experience had been. And I think one of my motivations for writing my own book, and certainly also a motivation for writing the novel, is the desire to just put it out there on the table. This is what a rape can look like. And if people maybe know more about it, then the victim's not as alienated, nor is the victim's family. And nor are people who live across the street as afraid of saying something really stupid, because maybe they're more educated about what the crime is.
Now, you said earlier that it was only after writing the beginning of your novel, The Lovely Bones, that you decided to go back and write a memoir about your rape. And you said it was because you wanted to, like, tell your own story so that your own story wasn't superimposed on your character's story. I'm interested in how your memory functioned of mm-hmm. the incident, because, you know, when after something that's about as traumatic as it gets happens to you, on the one hand, you really want to forget it so that it's not obsessing you and haunting you all the time. On the other hand, I suppose in a lot of ways you don't want to lose the memories that have been recorded so that you can continue to comprehend the experience. So did you find that you had, like, vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the rape itself and the incidents surrounding the rape, like the trial, was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards. You know, I very directly went into therapy right after the rape, all miserable experiences. And then I didn't do anything like that for about the next 10 years. And I found a lovely therapist who had the, you know, uniqueness of being free in New York and worked with her. But one of the things that was the funniest thing for me is that I had written an article for the New York Times Sunday Magazine about rape and had been quoted in a book called Trauma and Recovery, which is an excellent book. And I bought it because I'd been such a miserable failure as a writer in my 20s that it was one of the few, like, places I had appeared in print. And on the subway home with the book, I realized that I was quoted in the first half, which was called Trauma, instead of the second half, which was called Recovery. And that strangely inspired me to read the whole book. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I realized that I had post-traumatic stress disorder and went from there. So only after, I'd say, a full 10 years away from the rape was I able to face the rape and deal with the clear memories of it. Luckily, one of the things I did right after the rape, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically and what the light had been like and things like that in a journal of mine. What
did you do with the journal? Did you lock it up and put it away?
It was in my parents' basement the whole time I lived in New York. So I, you know, that's when you just love your parents for having a waterlogged, messy basement.
So the book was, the journal was still readable?
Yeah, the journal was readable, yeah.
And what was the experience of opening up the journal after a period of years had elapsed and reading it in the voice that you had a few years ago, reading the description?
I would say it was mind-blowing for a couple of reasons, and not the least of which was to realize what I had actually experienced. Because I think while you're going through it, you just, especially if you have the chance of going through a trial, which I did, you need to keep your eye on the ball. You need to be focused. You can't really drift off into maximum pain. So to go back and look at the accounts of what was actually happening, you know, I have to say, I just thought like, hey, kid, you did okay.
You were already interested in writing when you were raped. You were a freshman in college. Later in college, you were studying with the poet Tess Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assignments she gave you after she realized about this trauma in your life was to write a poem that started, "If They Caught You."
Right.
I could see you responding one of two ways to that. One way to go, oh, give me a break, and the other to actually write a great poem. tell us what your response was to that.
I think with Tess, who was one of those teachers, I mean, I have taught and I have had wonderful teachers, and I believe that atmosphere, particularly for those students who are going through anything traumatic, can be an incredible atmosphere. And Tess did not shy away from dealing with a student who I'm sure a lot of people just thought, like, eek, keep her away from me. She might explode on me. She forced my hand on that. I had written a vague kind of poem about rape. We had a discussion in her office. She asked me if it were based on anything that had actually happened to me in my life. I told her, and then she suggested that. I admired her greatly as a poet. She was an extremely empathetic teacher. And out of that, I decided, okay, she's forcing me to do something. It feels a little weird. But it was a great thing to do. So, and they caught him a week later. So who knows? There was a little magic in that assignment.
People often wonder if writing is therapeutic. If you're writing about a trauma, does that help the pain of the trauma recede? I mean, Susie in the novel says something about, I forget exactly what she says, but it's something like every time she tells her story, like a drop of the pain goes away.
Right.
But as a writer yourself who's written about your own trauma and then written a mm-hmm. fictionalized version of a similar trauma, is writing therapeutic or do you think that that's really the wrong way to approach it anyways?
My feeling, and it's pretty, you know, rigorous, is that therapy is for therapy, and that writing can be therapeutic, but therapeutic writing should not be published. My job as a writer is to go through the therapy myself, and if I manage to get through it and I feel I have something to share from that, to share it with my audience or my readers, but I don't write novels and seek to have them published so that I can get therapy from having written them. That's really the responsibility of an individual to do outside the context of their published work.
Writers usually have to have some kind of empathy and understanding of each of their characters, the good guys and the bad guys. Do you feel like in your novel you had to have empathy for the rapist, who's a man from the neighborhood? He's a man that the family knows.
Definitely. I mean, in my own personal belief, you can't write a good character unless you have both compassion and respect for them. So Mr. Harvey, who is the killer in the book, yes, I have great compassion for him. There are moments where he attempts to try to do things other than what his driver's instinct is telling him to do, by counting things obsessively or building things. So he resists up until the point where he's no longer able to resist. And, you know, that is, you can have compassion without forgiveness. And I think that's what I would say.
Were you able to find that kind of compassion for the man who raped you?
I would say eventually, certainly not immediately. But, you know, we're all born into this world in very different ways, and we have different experiences of it. And I don't know a lot about him, but some of the things I do know led me to feel compassion for him. There are also many people who had much more worse circumstances than he did that have managed not to go out and rape people. But that doesn't mean you can't have compassion for them. I don't forgive him, but, you know, he's a human being. You have to move on. You know, it's just as simple as that. And so you find a way to move on, and having compassion for people just in general is a good way to live in life.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold is the author of the novel The Lovely Bones. She's also the author of a 1999 memoir called Lucky.